Part 4 Chapter 1 About a week had passed since the meeting of the two persons of our story on the green seat. One bright morning, about 10:30, Varvara Ardilyanovna Titsin was returning from visiting some friends, plunged in mournful reflection. There are people whom it is difficult to describe completely in their typical and characteristic aspect. These are the people who are usually called ordinary, the majority, and who do actually make up the vast majority of mankind. Authors, for the most part, attempt in their tales and novels to select and represent vividly and artistically types rarely met with in actual life in their entirety, though they are, nevertheless, almost more real than real life itself. Podkoleosin, as a type, is perhaps exaggerated, but not at all unreal. What numbers of clever people, after being introduced by Gogol to Podkoleosin, at once discovered that tens and hundreds of their friends and acquaintances were extraordinarily like him. They knew before reading Gogol that their friends were like Podkoleosin, only they did not know what name to give them. In real life, extremely few bridegrooms jump out of windows just before their wedding, for, apart from other considerations, it's not a convenient mode of escape. Yet how many men, even intelligent and virtuous persons, on the eve of their wedding day, have been ready to acknowledge at the bottom of their hearts that they were Podkoleosins? Not all husbands exclaim at every turn, "Tu l'as voulu, Georges Dandin!" But how many millions and billions of times that cry from the heart has been uttered by husbands all the world over after the honeymoon, or, who knows, even perhaps the day after the wedding? Without entering into deeper considerations, we will simply point out that in actual life, typical characteristics are apt to be watered down, and that Georges Dandins and Podkoleosins exist and are moving before our eyes every day, only in a less concentrated form. With the reservation that Georges Dandin, in full perfection, as Molière has portrayed him, may also be met with in real life, though not frequently, we will conclude our reflections, which are beginning to be suggestive of newspaper criticism. Yet the question remains, what is an author to do with ordinary people? Absolutely ordinary. And how can he put them before his readers so as to make them at all interesting? It is impossible to leave them out of fiction altogether, for commonplace people are at every moment the chief and essential links in the chain of human affairs. If we leave them out, we lose all semblance of truth. To fill a novel completely with types, or more simply, to make it interesting with strange and incredible characters, would be to make it unreal and even uninteresting. To our thinking, a writer ought to seek out interesting and instructive features, even among commonplace people. When, for instance, the very nature of some commonplace persons lies just in their perpetual and invariable commonplaceness, or better still, when in spite of the most strenuous efforts to escape from the daily round of commonplaceness and routine, they end by being left invariably forever chained to the same routine, such people acquire a typical character of their own, the character of a commonplaceness, desirous above all things of being independent and original, without the faintest possibility of becoming so. To this class of commonplace or ordinary people belong certain persons of my tale, who have, hitherto, I must confess, been insufficiently explained to the reader. Such were Varvara Ardilyanovna Titsin, her husband, Mr. Titsin, and her brother, Gavril Ardilyanovich. There is, indeed, nothing more annoying than to be, for instance, wealthy, of good family, nice-looking, fairly intelligent, and even good-natured, and yet to have no talents, no special faculty, no peculiarity even, not one idea of one's own, to be precisely like other people, to have a fortune, but not the wealth of Rothschild, to be an honourable family, but one which has never distinguished itself in any way, to have a pleasing appearance, expressive of nothing in particular, to have a decent education, but to have no idea what use to make of it, to have intelligence, but no ideas of one's own, to have a good heart, but without any greatness of soul, and so on and so on. There is an extraordinary multitude of such people in the world, far more than appears. They may, like all other people, be divided into two classes, some of limited intelligence, others much cleverer. The first are happier. Nothing is easier for ordinary people of limited intelligence than to imagine themselves exceptional and original, and to revel in that delusion without the slightest misgiving. Some of our young ladies have only to crop their hair, put on blue spectacles, and dub themselves nihilists, to persuade themselves at once that they have immediately gained convictions of their own. Some men have only to feel the faintest stirring of some kindly and humanitarian emotion to persuade themselves at once that no one feels as they do, that they stand in the foremost rank of culture. Some have only to meet with some idea by hearsay, or to read some stray page, to believe at once that it is their own opinion, and has sprung spontaneously from their own brain. The impudence of simplicity, if one may so express it, is amazing in such cases. It is almost incredible, but yet often to be met with. This impudence of simplicity, this unhesitating confidence of the stupid man in himself and his talents, is superbly depicted by Gogol in the wonderful character of Lieutenant Pirogov. Pirogov has no doubt that he is a genius, superior indeed to any genius. He is so positive of this that he never questions it, and indeed he questions nothing. The great writer is forced in the end to chastise him for the satisfaction of the outraged moral feeling of the reader. But seeing that the great man simply shook himself after the castigation and fortified himself by consuming a pie, he flung up his hands in amazement and left his readers to make the best of it. I always regretted that Gogol took his great Pirogov from so humble a rank, for he was so self-satisfied that nothing could be easier for him than to imagine himself, as his epaulettes grew thicker and more twisted with years and promotion, an extraordinary military genius, or rather not imagine it, but simply take it for granted. Since he had been made a general, he must have been a military genius. And how many such have made terrible blunders afterwards on the field of battle? And how many Pirogovs have there been among our writers, savants, and propagandists? I say have been, but of course we have them still. Gavril Ardalionovitch Ivolgin belonged to the second category. He belonged to the class of the much cleverer people, though he was infected from head to foot with the desire for originality. But that class, as we observed above, is far less happy than the first. For the clever, commonplace man, even if he occasionally, or even always, fancies himself a man of genius and originality, yet preserves the worm of doubt gnawing at his heart, which in some cases drives the clever man to utter despair. Even if he submits, he is completely poisoned by his vanities being driven inwards. But we have taken an extreme example. In the vast majority of these clever people, things do not end so tragically. Their liver is apt to be affected in their declining years, and that's all. But before giving in and humbling themselves, such men sometimes play the fool for years, all from the desire of originality. There are strange instances of it, indeed. An honest man is sometimes, for the sake of being original, ready to do something base. It sometimes happens that one of these luckless men is not only honest but good, is the guardian angel of his family, maintains by his labour outsiders as well as his own kindred, and yet can never be at rest all his life. The thought that he has so well fulfilled his duties is no comfort or consolation to him. On the contrary, it irritates him. "This is what I've wasted all my life on," he says. "This is what has fettered me hand and foot. This is what has hindered me from doing something great. Had it not been for this, I should certainly have discovered gunpowder, or America. I don't know precisely what, but I would certainly have discovered it." What is most characteristic of these gentlemen is that they can never find out for certain what it is that they are destined to discover, and what they are within an ace of discovering. But their sufferings, their longings for what was to be discovered, would have sufficed for a Columbus or a Galileo. Gavril Ardalionovitch had taken the first step on that road, but he was only at its beginning. He had many years of playing the fool before him. A profound and continual consciousness of his own lack of talent, and at the same time the overwhelming desire to prove to himself that he was a man of great independence, had rankled in his heart almost from his boyhood up. He was a young man of violent and envious cravings, who seemed to have been positively born with his nerves overwrought. The violence of his desires he took for strength. His passionate craving to distinguish himself sometimes led him to the brink of most ill-considered actions. But our hero was always at the last moment too sensible to take the final plunge. That drove him to despair. He could perhaps have made up his mind to anything extremely base to attain what he dreamed of. But as fate would have it, he always turned out to be too honest for any great meanness. Small meannesses he was, however, prepared for. He looked with loathing and hatred on the downfall and poverty of his family. He treated even his mother haughtily and contemptuously, though he knew perfectly well that his mother's reputation and character were the pivot on which his future rested. When he entered General Epanchin's house, he said to himself at once, "Since I must be mean, let me be so thoroughly, if only to win my game," and was scarcely ever thoroughly mean. And why should he imagine that he would certainly need to be mean? Of Aglaya, he was simply frightened at the time, but he kept on with her on the off chance, though he never seriously believed that she would stoop to him. Afterwards, at the time of his affair with Nastasia Philipovna, he suddenly imagined that money would be the means of attaining everything. "If I must be mean, well, then I will," he repeated to himself every day with satisfaction, but with a certain dismay. "If one must be mean, let us be first-rate at it," he urged himself continually. "Commonplace people are afraid to be, but I am not." Losing Aglaya and crushed by circumstances, he completely lost heart, and actually brought Mushkin the money flung him by a madwoman to whom it had been given by a madman. 1,000 times afterwards he regretted having returned that money, though he was continually priding himself upon it. He did actually shed tears for 3 days while Mushkin was in Petersburg, but in those 3 days he grew to hate the prince, because the latter looked at him too compassionately, though not everyone would have had the strength for such a deed as returning that money. But the frank confession to himself that his misery was due to nothing but the continual mortification of his vanity distressed him horribly. Only long afterwards he saw and realized what a different ending an affair with such a strange and innocent creature as Aglaya might have had. He was consumed by regrets. He threw up his post and sank into despondency and dejection. He lived with his father and mother in Titsin's house and at the latter's expense, and openly despised Titsin, although he followed his advice and had the sense almost always to ask it. Gavriil Ardalionovitch was angry, for instance, with Titsin for not aiming at becoming a Rothschild. "If you go in for usury, do it thoroughly. Squeeze people, coin money out of them, show willpower, be a king among the Jews." Titsin was unassuming and quiet. He did nothing but smile. But once he thought it necessary to have a serious explanation with Ganya, and he carried out the task with a certain degree of dignity. He had proved to Ganya that he was doing nothing dishonest, and that he had no right to call him a grasping Jew, that it was not his fault that money was so valuable, that he was acting honestly and justly, and that in reality he was only an intermediary in these affairs, and that finally, thanks to his accuracy in business, he was already favourably known to first-rate people, and his business was increasing. "I shall never be a Rothschild, and I don't want to be," he said, smiling. "But I shall have a house in Litini, perhaps 2 even, and there I shall stop. And who knows, perhaps even 3, he thought to himself, but he never uttered this aloud. He concealed that daydream. Nature loves such people, and is kind to them. She will reward Titsin not with 3, but with 4 houses, and just because he has realized from childhood that he will never become a Rothschild. But beyond 4 houses, nature will not go, and Titsin's success will end there. Gavriil Ardalionovitch's sister was quite a different person. She too was possessed with strong desires, but they were rather persistent than impulsive. She had plenty of common sense in emergencies, and was not devoid of it indeed in everyday life. It is true that she also was one of the ordinary people who dream of being original. Yet she very soon found out that she had no particular originality, and did not take it too much to heart. Perhaps, who knows, from pride of a sort. She took her first practical step with great decision in marrying Titsin. But in getting married, she did not say to herself, "If I must be mean, I will be mean so long as I gain my end," as her brother Ganya would certainly have said to himself, and may possibly have said aloud to her when he gave his approval as elder brother to the match. Quite the contrary, in fact. Varvara Ardelyanovna married after having convinced herself that her future husband was a pleasant, unassuming, almost educated man who could never be induced to do anything very dishonourable. As for minor acts of meanness, Varvara Ardelyanovna did not worry about such trifles, and in fact, one can find such trifles everywhere. It's no good looking for an ideal being. She knew, besides, that by marrying, she would provide a refuge for her mother, her father, and her brothers. Seeing her brother in trouble, she wanted to help him, in spite of all their previous misunderstandings. Titsin sometimes urged Ganya, in a friendly way, of course, to take another post. "You despise generals, and being a general," he would say to him sometimes in joke, "but mind, they will all finish by being generals. If you live long enough, you will see." "But what makes them think that I despise generals and being a general?" Ganya thought ironically to himself. For her brother's sake, Varvara Ardelyanovna made up her mind to enlarge her circle of acquaintance. She managed to get her footing at the Epanchins. The memories of childhood stood her in good stead there, for she and Ganya had played with the Epanchins as children. We may observe here that if Varvara Ardelyanovna had visited the Epanchins in pursuit of some fantastic dream, by that very fact she would have excluded herself from that class of people with whom she mentally ranked herself. But she was not pursuing a dream. She was working on a fairly firm basis. She was reckoning on the peculiarities of the Epanchin family. She was never tired of studying Aglaia's character. The task she set before herself was to bring those two, Aglaia and her brother, together again. Possibly she actually did attain this object to some extent. Possibly she made blunders, building perhaps too much on her brother and expecting from him what he could not under any circumstances have given. In any case, she behaved with considerable art at the Epanchins. For weeks together she made no allusion to her brother. She was always extremely truthful and sincere. She behaved simply, but with dignity. As for the depths of her conscience, she was not afraid to look into them, and she did not reproach herself for anything in the least. It was that that gave her power. There was only one thing she noticed in herself, that she too was spiteful, that she too had a great deal of amour propre, and one might almost say of mortified vanity. She noticed it particularly at certain moments, especially almost every time she was walking home from the Epanchins. And just now she was on her way back from them, and as we have said already, she was dejected and preoccupied. A shade of bitter mockery was apparent in her dejection. At Pavlovsk, Titsin occupied a roomy but not very attractive-looking house in a dusty street, which would, within a short period, become his own property, so that he was already negotiating for the sale of it. As she was going up the steps, Varvara Ardelyanovna heard an extraordinary noise from upstairs and caught the voices of her father and brother shouting at one another. Going to the drawing-room and seeing Ganya running to and fro, white with fury and almost tearing his hair, she frowned, and with a weary air sank on the sofa without taking off her hat. Knowing that if she let a minute pass without asking her brother why he was in such a state, he would certainly be angry with her, Varia hastened to observe, in the form of a question, "The usual story?" "The usual story, indeed!" cried Ganya. "The usual story? No! The devil only knows what is happening here is not the same as usual. The old man is getting perfectly frantic. Mother's in floods of tears. Upon my word, Varia, I'll turn him out. Say what you like, or I'll go away myself," he added, probably recollecting that it was not possible to turn anyone out of another person's house. "You must make allowances," murmured Varia. "What allowances? For whom?" cried Ganya, firing up. "For his filthy habits? No, you may say what you like. That's impossible. Impossible, impossible, impossible. And what a way to behave. He is in fault, and it makes him all the more stuck up. The gate is not good enough for him. He must pull the wall down. Why are you sitting there like that? You don't look yourself.
I look as I always do,
Faria answered with displeasure. Ganya looked at her more carefully. Have you been there? He asked suddenly.
Yes.
Stay shouting again! What a disgrace, and at such a time, too.
What sort of time? There's no special time.
Ganya looked more intently than ever at his sister. Have you found out something more? He asked.
Nothing unexpected, anyway. I found out that it's all a fact. My husband was nearer the truth than either of us. It's turned out just as he predicted from the beginning. Where is he?
Not at home. What's turned out?
The prince is formally betrothed to her. The thing is settled. The elder girls told me. Aglaia consents. They have even left off keeping it dark. There's always been so much mystery till now. Adelaida's wedding will be put off again, so that the two weddings may be on the one day. Such a romantic notion. Quite poetical. You'd better be writing a poem for the occasion than running about the room to no purpose. Princess Bielokonski will be there this evening. She's come in the nick of time. There are to be visitors. He is to be presented to the Princess Bielokonski, though she knows him already. I believe the engagement will be publicly announced. They are only afraid he may let something drop or break something when he walks into the drawing room, or else flop down himself. It's quite in his line.
Ganya listened very attentively, but to his sister's surprise, this news, which ought to have overwhelmed him, seemed to have by no means an overwhelming effect on him.
Well, that was clear, he said after a moment's thought.
So it's the end, he added with a strange smile, glancing slyly into his sister's face and still walking up and down the room, but much more quietly.
It's a very good thing you take it like a philosopher.
I'm glad, really, said Faria. Yes, it's a load off one's mind. Off yours, anyway.
I think I've served you sincerely without criticizing or annoying you. I didn't ask you what sort of happiness you expected with Aglaia.
Why? Was I expecting happiness from Aglaia?
Oh, please don't discuss it philosophically. Of course you were. It's all over, and there's nothing more for us to do. We've been fools. I must own I could never take the thing quite seriously. It was simply on the off chance that I took it up. I was reckoning on her ridiculous character, and my chief object was to please you. It was 10-1 it would come to nothing.
I don't know to this day what you have been hoping for. Now your husband and you will be trying to make me get a job. You'll give me lectures on perseverance and strength of will, not despising small profits and all the rest of it.
I know it by heart, laughed Ganya. He has something new in his mind, Faria thought to herself.
How are they taking it? Are they pleased? The father and mother? Ganya asked suddenly.
No, I think not.
However, you can judge for yourself. Ivan Fyodorovich is pleased. The mother is uneasy. She's always viewed him with dislike as a suitor. We know that. I don't mean that. He's an impossible suitor, unthinkable. That's evident. I was talking about their attitude now. What's their line now? Has she given her formal consent?
She hasn't so far said no, that's all. But that's all one could expect from her. You know how insanely shy and bashful she still is. When she was a child, she would creep into a cupboard and sit there for 2 or 3 hours, simply to escape seeing visitors. Though she has grown such a maypole, she is just the same now. You know, I believe there really is something in it, even on her side. They say she is laughing at the prince from morning till night, so as to hide her feelings. But she must manage to say something on the sly to him every day, for he looks as though he were in heaven. He's beaming. He is fearfully funny, they say. I heard it from them. I fancied, too, that they laughed at me to my face, the elder girls.
Ganya at last began to frown. Perhaps Varya went on enlarging on the subject on purpose to get at his real view, but they heard a shout again upstairs.
"I'll turn him out!"
Ganya fairly roared, as though glad to vent his annoyance.
"And then he will go disgracing us everywhere, as he did yesterday."
"Yesterday? What do you mean? Why, did he—" Ganya seemed dreadfully alarmed all of a sudden.
"Oh, dear. Didn't you know?"
Varya pulled herself up.
"What?
"'Surely it isn't true that he has been there!' cried Ganya, flushing crimson with shame and anger. "'Good heavens! Why, you've come from there. Have you heard something about it? Has the old man been there? Has he or not?' And Ganya rushed to the door. Varya flew to him and clutched him with both hands. "'What are you about? Where are you going?' she said. "'If you let him out now, he will do more harm than ever. He will go to everyone. What did he do there? What did he say?' "'Well, they couldn't tell me themselves.' They haven't understood it. He only frightened them all. He went to see Ivan Fyodorovich. He was out. He asked to see Lizaveta Prokofievna. First he asked her about a post, wanted to get a job, and then he began complaining of us, of me, of my husband, of you especially. He talked a lot of stuff. "'You couldn't find out what?' Ganya was quivering hysterically. "'How could I? He scarcely knew what he was saying himself, and perhaps they did not tell me everything.' Ganya clutched at his head and ran to the window. Varya sat down at the other window. "'Aglaya is an absurd creature,' she observed suddenly. "'She stopped me and said, "'Please give your parents my special respects. "'I shall certainly have an opportunity of seeing your father one of these days.' "'And she said that so seriously. "'It was awfully queer. "'Not in derision. "'Not in derision. "'That's just it, it wasn't. "'That is what was so queer.' "'Does she know about the old man or not? What do you think?' "'There's no doubt in my mind that they don't know in the family. "'But you've given me an idea. "'Aglaya perhaps does know. "'She is the only one who does know, perhaps, "'for her sisters were surprised, too, "'when she sent her greeting to father so seriously. "'And why to him particularly? "'If she does know, the prince must have told her. "'Well, it's not difficult to guess who told her. "'A thief! "'It's the last straw.' "'A thief in our family! The head of the house!' "'That's nonsense!' cried Varya, losing patience. "'A drunken prank, that's all. And who made up the story? Lebedev, the prince. They are a nice lot themselves. They are wise people. Don't believe a word of it. "'The old man is a thief and a drunkard!' Ganya went on bitterly. "'I'm a beggar. My sister's husband is a moneylender. An alluring prospect for Aglaya. A lovely state of things and no mistake!' "'That sister's husband, who is a moneylender, is keeping me, you mean? "'Don't mince matters, please!' "'Why are you so cross?' said Varya, restraining herself. "'You are a regular schoolboy. You don't understand anything. "'You think all this might injure you in Aglaya's eyes? "'You don't know her. "'She'd refuse the most eligible suitor and run off delighted with some student to starve in a garret. "'That's her dream!' "'You've never been able to understand how interesting you would have become in her eyes "'if you'd been able to bear our surroundings with pride and fortitude. "'The prince has hooked her, in the first place, because he wasn't fishing for her, "'and secondly, because he is looked upon by everyone as an idiot. "'The very fact that she is upsetting her family about him is a joy to her. "'Ugh, you don't understand.' "'Well, we shall see whether I understand or not,' Ganya muttered enigmatically. "'Still,' "'I shouldn't like her to know about the old man. "'I thought Mushkin would have been able to hold his tongue. "'He made Lebedev keep quiet. "'He didn't want to speak out to me when I insisted on knowing.
"'So you see that apart from him it has leaked out. "'And what does it matter to you now? "'What are you hoping for? "'And even if you had any hope left, "'it would only make her look on you as a martyr.
"'Well, even she would be a coward about a scandal, "'in spite of all her romantic notions.' "'It's all up to a certain point, and everyone draws the line somewhere. "'You're all alike.'
"'Aglaya would be a coward?'
"'Varya fired up, looking contemptuously at her brother.
"'You've got a mean little soul.
"'You are all a worthless lot. "'She may be absurd and eccentric, "'but she is a thousand times more generous than any of us.'
"'Well, never mind. "'Never mind, don't be cross,' Ganya murmured again complacently.
"'I'm sorry for Mother, that's all,'
Varya went on. "'I'm so afraid this scandal about Father may reach her ears.
Oh, "'I'm afraid it will. "'No doubt it has reached her,' observed Ganya.
"'Varya had risen to go upstairs to Nina Alexandrovna, "'but stopping short, she looked attentively at her brother.
"'Who could have told her?'
"'Ippolit, most likely. "'It would have been the greatest satisfaction to him "'to report the matter to Mother. "'As soon as he moved here, I expect.
"'But how does he know? "'Tell me that, pray.' "'The prince and Lebedev made up their minds to tell nobody. "'Kolya knows nothing.
"'Ippolit. "'He found it out for himself. "'You can't imagine what a sly beast he is, "'what a gossip he is, how quick he is at sniffing out anything bad, any sort of scandal. You may not believe it, but I'm sure he's succeeded in getting a hold on Aglaia. And if he hasn't, he will. Rogozhin has got to know him, too. How is it the prince does not notice it? And how eager he is to score off me now? He looks upon me as his personal enemy. I've seen that a long time. Why, and with what object, since he is dying, I can't make out. But I'll get the better of him. You will see that I'll score off him, not he off me.
What made you then entice him here, if you hate him so? And is he worth scoring off?
You advised me to entice him here.
I thought he would be of use. But do you know that he has fallen in love with Aglaia himself now, and has been writing to her? They asked me about him. He may even have written to Lizaveta Prokofievna.
He's not dangerous in that way, said Ganya with a spiteful laugh. But most likely you are mistaken. It's very possible he is in love, for he is a boy. But he wouldn't write anonymous letters to the old lady. He is such a spiteful, insignificant, self-satisfied mediocrity. I'm convinced, I know, that he represented me to her as a scheming adventurer. That's what he began with. I must own that, like a fool, I talked to him freely at first. I thought that simply to revenge himself on the prince he'd work in my interests. He is such a sly beast. Ugh, I've seen through him now completely. And he heard about that theft from his mother, the captain's widow. If the old man did bring himself to it, it was for that woman's sake. He suddenly told me, apropos of nothing, that the general had promised his mother 400 rubles. And he told me that without the least ceremony, absolutely apropos of nothing. Then I understood it all. And he peered right in my face with a sort of glee. He's told mother, too, most likely, for the mere pleasure of breaking her heart. And why on earth doesn't he die, pray? He promised to die in 3 weeks, and here he is getting fatter. He's coughing less. He said himself last night that he hadn't brought up blood for 2 days.
Turn him out.
I don't hate him. I despise him, Ganya pronounced proudly. Well, yes, I do hate him, then, I do, he shouted suddenly with extraordinary fury. And I'll tell him so to his face, even if he lies dying on his bed. If you'd read his confession, good Lord, the naivety of its insolence. He's a regular Lieutenant Pirogov, a Nozdryov, turned tragic, and above all, he is a puppy. Oh, how I should have enjoyed thrashing him, simply to surprise him. Now he wants to pay everyone out because he failed to... What was that? A noise again? What can it be, really? Oh, I won't put up with it, Titsin, he cried to his brother-in-law, who came into the room. What's the meaning of this? What are we coming to? This is... But the noise was quickly coming nearer. The door was suddenly flung open, and old Ivolgin, wrathful, crimson in face and beside himself with agitation, attacked Titsin, too. The old man was followed by Nina Alexandrovna, Kolya, and the last of all, Ippolit.